You know, I think about now I have time to tell a story, and I'm going to tell how it was and what happened to me. I'm going to tell how it was and what happened to me and what it's like now. I think about all the stories when I was growing up I was told as a kid. And one of the things that I always remember is my mom telling me when I was like 4 years old, she told me, I used to go to bed with a bottle of milk. And one night, you know, she tried to take that away and, you know, wean me off the milk. And I came out into the kitchen with my six guns and a cowboy hat. And I said, "Give me the bottle or I'll kill you." And she tells that story. And I think back and I think, you know, when I was older, I kept using that line. That's kind of, it's funny. And it tells a little how it was for me growing up because my father drank. And all the time that I saw the adults having fun, they were always drinking. There was always a picnic table with bottles of vodka around. And they'd be all shooting the breeze and telling stories and having a great time. And all my role models were these people who seemed to have these real colorful lives and real involved in social affairs and seemed like good people. And they were all having a good time drinking and getting drunk. They're shooting at me. Anyway, you know, I can remember hearing this tape about somebody seeing the flamethrower at my ass that was got me at AA. And now, maybe he spoke here before. So I grew up around that, and you know, I was loved as a kid, and I was in a pretty decent home, and, you know, I felt safe in a lot of ways, but I grew up afraid of a lot of things, and I was a little weird, you know, I went to a psych. And when I became a teenager, it was in the 60s, and I started drinking. I can remember the first time I got drunk, I'd taken a bottle of vodka and mixed it with some Hawaiian punch, and that was my first drunk. And one of the things when I was a kid that age is, you know, I wasn't good at sports, and I wasn't real good at playing the trumpet and all these things. And I didn't like to do anything unless I was the best at it. And so I kind of stayed away from things, and I was a loner. But when I got drunk, I was the best at it in my peer group. I held the most booze, I didn't puke, I was funny, and it was what worked for me. And with that, I drank, always wanting to get drunk, always wanting to pass out, and I never drank socially. Don't even really, can't conceive of it. And I went along like that in my, I was in the suburbs of New York, and my parents sent me away to a school in Vermont for a while, and it was in the late 60s, and a lot of drugs around. The school was co-ed, and I had a great time. You know, I was young, and getting high and getting drunk was what I liked to do. And it was at that time that I noticed that the drug I really liked was alcohol. You know, everybody else liked a lot of other things, but that was the one that I always wanted to do. And so those were kind of years full of turmoil, and it was 1969, and my father decided he wanted to leave what we were doing in New York. And he moved us all to California. And we had an old Rambler, like the hillbillies. I mean, an old Rambler with a utility trailer. And I was all for this project. I said, "Yeah, we'll go to California." And I was 15. And my younger sister and my mother, who had, you know, lives in New York, they were very much against it. And my father was kind of tyrannical about it, and he said, "No, we're going." And so it was kind of an unhappy trip. Wound up coming out here to San Francisco and then to Santa Rosa, which we had heard was a good place. And I remember going to Santa Rosa High. I was a new senior for about a month, and I didn't fit in. That was a little, I don't know, it was just a little different from what I was like. And so we found a free school, which at the time was like alternative schools. It was really no school. It was just where you did whatever you wanted. And I managed to graduate. I managed to graduate like 6 months early. And this kid was a good artist, and he drew up a diploma, and they graduated me. And we moved up here to Albion, where I built the geodesic dome with my father. And I can remember in the dome, was the first time that my father really put the blessing on me drinking in the house openly. And, you know, first it was, oh, yeah, you can have a couple of glasses of wine, but I was not drinking like that. And I'd sit there and get drunk with this man, hoping that it was going to open up this whole field of opportunity of communication. And it did not do that. It was a kind of a sad thing that we both just got drunk. And I know it, you know, it was a hurtful thing for my mom, who's still around. And actually, I'm seeing her while I'm up here. So I was like 16 years old, and I was up here as mostly older people. And I teamed up with somebody who was a lot older than me, and went up cutting wood and making tables out of the wood. And I really liked that. I felt like, well, now I can do what I want, and I'm only hurting myself. Get up every morning, bottle of brandy, hot peppers, all sorts of, you know, great, great dietary things. And I was just, and I was 16, 17 years old, and this is how I was becoming a person. And it was this whole myth at that time of the freedom to put in your body what you want. And somehow the feeling that you were free now, and you're free to do that. And I look back at that and see, you know, how misleading that is. And it's sad because it still goes on. I wound up, at the same time, I had my old teacher from Vermont come out, and he had gotten thrown out of the school. and he decided that we would go back to Provincetown in Massachusetts and sell our poetry. So I said, well, that's a good idea. So we went to, I flew back east and went with him, and we went to Provincetown in July 4th weekend of 1971 and sold these books of poetry. We put it up on a Xerox machine with some friend of his that he knew in Boston. We burned up the Xerox machine. I remember just leaving and going, oh, sorry, you know. And we sold the books of poems in Provincetown, and it was July 4th weekend. I made $500. I said, wow, this money grows on trees. Look at this. And I took the money, and I bought a school bus in back in New York. And I drove the school bus cross country in some kind of great cosmic trip, which was just really... And I can remember this bus had this place. It was like a heater, a nice flat spot where you could put a bottle of tequila. And I drove across country like that. And left the bus yellow, and the police left me alone. And I can remember in Wyoming stopping and picking up hitchhikers that had been there like 2 days at a place. And they, wow, thank you. I said, shh, right in the bus again. Came back to California with my bus, and what was I going to do? I get confused in my own story. It's like everybody doing the readings, huh? I came back, and I wound up working with that older guy for a while, and made money. I went down. I remember going down to the Bay Area to sell the slabs, and in Berkeley, going on Telegraph Avenue, and all these signs in all these little stores, 1971, says, no heroin dealers allowed. So what is allowed? You know, and I said, this is a neat little area, and I kept that in my little bank of knowledge. And then I got into heroin. I felt that it was helping me control my alcohol problem. And it's, you know, booze lasted a little longer when you're passed out a few hours. So I went like that, and I'm turning 18, 19, and moved up to Humboldt County, where I thought I could stretch out a little more. This was a little too tame here in Mendocino. And at that time, my father had left my mother and gone to live at a commune. And so my family broke up. My mother went down to San Francisco. I was floating around up in Humboldt County, living in another school bus in the woods, drinking every day. There's big bars up there. What do we got here, folks? Anyway, the butterflies that you warned me about. So I was up in Humboldt County, and there's a lot of outlaws up there. A lot of people with just first names like Fastus, and you know. And I thought that was a great place. I really, you know, it's just the kind of place where I could get up in the morning, get drunk, and I fit in. And I really felt like wasn't hurting anybody but myself. It's my business. is what I wanted to do. And I, and at the same time, I had been instilled with a work ethic, which kept me working. So I always was making my money quasi-legally. You know, I wasn't out robbing people. And it worked out. I'd sell wood, you know, money grew on trees. I take the wood, I sell it at the flea market, I turn it into cash and get loaded. My father left my mother, went to Mexico, and on the way back, he was sick, and he found out he had Lou Gehrig's disease. And my mother, he wound up going back to see my mother, and my mother took him back in and said, I'll take care of you. So my whole family wound up regrouping in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury. Anyway, that was, for me, it was like a kid in the candy store at that point, because I was down there. I quickly found out where to get anything I wanted. All the bars on Hay Street loved me. I spent the money, and I was like 21. and I always saw that as much as people wanted to smoke weed and stuff, I liked to drink. I really liked the idea of liquid. I never smoked cigarettes, and I liked the idea of drinking something. That's what I wanted to do. That's how I liked to get loaded. And other people went on to do other things. That's what I stayed with. There were a lot of days where I didn't do something else, where I wouldn't use, Marston called it? Solid alcohol. But I always drank. There wasn't a day that went by where I didn't drink. And I can remember just every day that was what was coming up down the line. It was so easy to get. It was so cheap. It was what did it for me. A good day for me were days where I passed out twice. I got drunk twice. That was a good day. And so I went. I built a basement apartment for my father as he died. And used to take care of him. Used to help exercise him. It was a hard time for me. And I guess to my credit, I stayed with it. I did it. But to my shame, I did it, you know, drunk and chemically addicted. I would take his medicine and inject it and know that he couldn't catch me because he was confined to a chair. There's a lot of pain remembering all that because a lot of shame that goes with why would I do that when someone so close to me was dying. But at the same time, that communication that one would think might blossom, it didn't. In the end, it was not a lot of communication. I grew up in an atheist household, and I was told that there is no God. You're responsible for what you do. It's all up to you. And in the last days of my father, I always wondered if he had changed. Hard to know, and it's just a stubbornness there that kind of went with him when he went. So my father dies after we took care of him for a few years, and I never mourned it. I got up the next day, took more of his medicine, drank some booze, and went and did a job to keep money coming in. And I felt like, well, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm just hurting myself, and it's my business. And at this time, you know, people in my family were concerned about me. There was always, oh, Bob, he did this again. And, oh, look, he's, you know, and there was always like, where we lived on Hay Street, there's like four unregistered trucks and wood all over the place. My mother pulling it up, you know. So I kept doing that, and I just said, well, I'll start my own business here in San Francisco. And I wound up renting a warehouse in the warehouse district, getting a small sawmill together and buying wood. And I started buying walnut stumps out of the valley. And I got a whole new clientele of people who wanted to buy walnut. I was selling the walnut again at the flea market in Marin, doing great, making money. Around the 28th of the month, I think about the rent. Oh, the rent's due. And then I go make the money, and that was my... And I used to say, man, we'll get loaded, and go from there. You know, there's no heavy plan to this. There was no 5-year plan. And I'd buy more trucks and more tools, and just, you know, it was like a grown-up kid. I had no sense of responsibility, but at the same time, I felt I was so responsible. Look, I had this business, and I go to work every day. The warehouse was right by the beer distributor, and there was nothing going to keep me away from my work, you know? And so I, I kept this warehouse for a long time, and I wound up, I sold on 19th Avenue. I had all sorts of deals going on. Wrecked a lot of cars. A lot of cars went down that time. I remember taking a Datsun pickup under a tractor trailer, take the top off. All sorts of wacky things that I walked away from. And one night, my warehouse burned down. Caught fire. Just like this fire. All the chainsaws were like little puddles on the ground. Walked in, the place looked like an atomic bomb. I don't feel a little meltdown and everything. So, minor setback. My partner went berserk. He went in tears. He went back to New York. He couldn't take it. He lost thousands, a lot of money. We were only 25 years old. So I said, well, it's time to build the second empire, you know. And I went and I went to work for my I can't tell his name. It's such a great name. But anyway, I went to work for my best commercial customer, my best wholesale customer. Within a few days, I was running his shop and selling for him on Fisherman's Wharf, where I posed as a street artist selling my wares. And really, that was like street theater, because I wound up saying, time to buy a clock. I put the clock in the tourist's face, you know. It was just, you know, I didn't have a lot of patience for it. I didn't really care if you bought it. And then in the end, I discovered the bar, kitty corner from the stand, and I'd sit in the bar, look out the window. If the tourists stayed 10 minutes, I'd come out and talk to them. You know, that was a live customer. And this went well. This went well. It was I called it my low-key sales technique. And it worked. And I made money. And I kept making money, and I wasn't hurting anybody but myself. The guy I was working for, he says, as long as you bring the money back and you know the truck's intact, I'm happy. So that all went real well. Then the economy slides in the United States. I wound up, things aren't going so well. Starting to hurt a little bit for money, and taking oddball carpentry jobs and building bars and trading for bar tab. And a lot of that. And my partner, who had gone back to New York, calls me up and he says, and at this time I was just starting to get to that point where, you know, I'm not eating real good. I'm like skipping a few meals and, you know, it's okay. I'll get the vitamins from the brandy. And you know, or slugging down vitamin C with the apricot brandy. Health nut, you know. I can remember, like, you know, doing things like that and then telling somebody drinking a Coca-Cola, say, how could you drink that? It's got preservatives in it. You know? And people, you know, yeah. And so here I was, a real basket case between the hard drugs and all the booze, and it was booze every day, lots of it. And my ex-partner calls me up and says, listen, I'll get you into the Carpenters Union in New York. You'll make good money. You can straighten your life out. So I thought about it. I said, yeah, that sounds real good. And so I pulled what is probably one of the stupidest geographicals ever. I moved to New York City to get away from alcohol and drugs. And I can remember flying out People's Express, the Airways. I used to fly out of Oakland. And I get on the plane. I had all sorts of contraband. And I just get on the plane. I'm going to go straighten my life out. And I'd gotten a DUI in San Francisco right before the laws had changed, right after the laws had changed. So I had to go through this program. And I remember sitting with the counselor in the program, sitting there, listen, I just want to go to New York for about 6 months and straighten my life out. She goes, oh, what a wonderful idea, Mr. Man. So I get the blessing to go. So I go. That was in 1981, and I was there quite a long time. I get to New York City, immediately I find out you don't have to know anybody to get drugs. You don't pick up the phone, you just walk the street. Very convenient. Also, the bars are open till 4 a.m. Plus, my partner's dating a topless dancer. I mean, it was not a good scene for putting your life together. And I immediately, I would say my chemical addiction and my alcoholism shifted into high gear, because here I was now making real good money. But again, I always went to my fallback of, the only person I'm hurting is myself. It's my business. It's my freedom. I can do what I want. And I stuck with that. And I was a good carpenter. I got a lot of sheetrock up. I did good. Bosses liked me. And that went on for a long time. I also got the... I got into my notion that if I married a straight suburban housewife, that would straighten my life out. And I met a woman at a bar. I was her second alcoholic husband, and married her. She had three children, 7, 10, and 13 years old. And I thought this would really straighten me out. And what it did was cause me, I didn't use drugs, but I used a lot more alcohol. And she saw it. I was buying gallons of wine, you know, just incredible amounts. People were just absolutely amazed that I would do all that and get up and go to work the next day, probably going to work with a blood alcohol count of God knows what. She stuck by me for a couple of years, and then one day it was just, you know, I had been coming home where I'd fall down the stairs and scare her kids, and I wasn't a very good stepfather. I was okay in some dimensions, but the boy had problems. I didn't know how to handle a boy's problems. I couldn't handle my own. I was a big grown-up kid. I didn't know nothing, you know. And so she put it to me like this. I remember she put this note up on the refrigerator. It says, The crime is not in having the disease of alcoholism. The crime is in knowing about it and not doing something about it. I remember this sitting on the refrigerator, and I just reached in there and bought, you know, get another beer. But it finally, it came back to haunt me, and that's why I say it. She put it to me. She says, it's me or the alcohol. I said, listen, I'll be right out. You know, and I packed up a quick bag, and I left. And that was how I felt. And it was, no one was going to tell me how to do my life. It was my freedom. I was only hurting myself. But now I hit a stage where I was really, you know, I was more or less living in little dives, little basement apartments that were, you know, a little window that I put a curtain over so no light would come in. And after work, I ran down there and I'd start hitting the rum and whatever and just drink myself into oblivion, maybe wake up and do it again. I can remember not feeling like I had the life skills to go to a grocery store and buy myself groceries. I'd feel like everybody would know I was something wrong with me. And you know what? That's a powerful feeling of all the people I've ever heard tell stories in AA of how different they all felt. And I know I felt very different as a kid. And it's a remarkable thing that's a commonality through a lot of people's stories. But anyway, I digress. So I'm drinking in basement apartments, getting to work, but starting to miss a few days. I remember since I couldn't go to grocery stores, buying a lot of Chinese food, you know. So in the refrigerator was now like a box of rice and, you know, rum and everything in it. And I got fired from a job, but I went to a bar and got another job where I knew the contractors drank. And said, oh, you looking for a job? Oh, yeah, sure, you know. I'd be without work a few days, and that might, you know, crimp my drug intake, which was painful. And I managed to keep going, keep working. I'd gotten a DUI out there and run through some Mickey Mouse drinking driver program. Kind of just blew it off. That was the one night I didn't drink until after the program. You know, that was how I handled that. And I kept doing what I was doing, and it was starting to get into me. I was 30-something years old, and it was starting to, you know, I wasn't young anymore. And it was, nutritionally, I was starting to get a little slowed down. The marriage was gone. The trucks all had character defects. The lights don't work. And it wasn't the fun days of back in the Marin County flea market. And I was just, New York's real kind of not, people aren't friendly like all you people. And somebody from New York. I'm living in all these stupid little apartments. I wound up moving to places I should never have lived. And what are you doing here? And I went one night to talk to someone about starting our own company. I said, oh, I'm going to build another empire. So we're going to do custom formwork for custom foundations or something. So I meet this guy. It was Labor Day in 1989. I meet him out at this bar. And I remember I was drinking vodka and cranberry juice because cranberry juice, you know, helps clean the liver. And so that was really going to help me along. We talked till I don't know, about 7 o'clock in the evening. Had a little something to eat. I was pretty bombed. I remember I was going my way back into New York City, and I got all turned around, and I wound up, my lights again, the dimming, and I'm, oh my God, I didn't want to go through the county that I got my DUI in, so I wound up going into Queens, and I'm driving on the wrong side of the road, and this, I see a kid run in front of me, and I step on my brakes, and the kid makes it past, and then I hear this thud, and I ran, I jumped out of my truck, I ran back, and I saw an 8-year-old boy in his 12-year-old brother's arms, dead. And all of a sudden, all that thinking about I was only hurting myself, and it was my business, all that just fell, and I saw what I had done. And I remember saying, oh my God, I killed a kid. And at that point, I knew everything had changed, and I was drunk. I was scared. I was scared of what I had done, and it was something I couldn't fix. There was no amount of conning or doing anything to fix what I had done. I ran away on foot. I just ran. I was not so much out of a fear for my safety or people beating me up or anything. Just absolutely petrified at what I had done, and I got away. And the next day, I see on the Eyewitness News, my van, they're looking all over for me, and I was hot, and I was scared. And at that time, I sort of looked at my options. I was in my friend's cabinet shop, shooting heroin, drinking Stoli vodka, and just wondering, what am I going to do? My options laid like suicide, go back to Humboldt County and hide out, or turn myself in. I called the cop. I called the lawyer who had been a cop for 25 years, who had done my DUI and my divorce. And I called him up and I told him what had happened. He says, give me the phone number where you're at and I'll call you right back. And he calls me back and he tells me, well, we're going to do this and you'll turn yourself in. And then he said these words to me and he says, no matter how bad it isn't something that you can't get through. And I clung to those words because I was scared and I was real, disgusted with what I had become and what I had done. I go with him and turn myself into a police precinct. And I appeared in a lineup. And the older brother picks me out and I was charged with manslaughter second degree. I was not charged with any drunk driving because I had run away. And at that time, they charged me the crime and I was thrown into the New York City prison system or the jail. It's really just county jail. And there's a lot of people there. And I was there, and I was a dry drunk now. Dry drunk. Spent like 40 hours before arraignment kicking cold turkey and just, you know, with the runs and just absolutely dried out. It wasn't anything I hadn't done before, and I was tough, and I was going to do this. And so shaking and kind of malnourished and absolutely petrified, I wandered into the county lockup. And when I went to arraignment, I figured, well, maybe I'll bail out of this. I'll get like 40 grand. And they put my bail at $250,000. And I said, oh, that doesn't look like I'm going to see light for a while. And I didn't. I stayed in county lockup. And I heard about AA, but I didn't want to go because I didn't want it to taint my case. Boy, I look back at that now. I can still remember them in the call. And I said, no. But somehow my higher power was pushing on me because at that time I knew that I had to be doing something to help and do things. And I wound up being a suicide prevention aide in the mental observation unit in the county lockup, which provided a lot of hours of entertainment with guys telling you the twin brother did it and all sorts of things like that. But it was also a chance for my humanness to sort of blossom, where I was in a position where I could just talk to people and they felt like I helped them. And I was amazed at that because here I was a dry drunk. I didn't know what was going on. And I always look at that as my higher power kind of nudging me and showing me things. And all this would be interspersed with an appearance in court where, handcuffed, I go before a judge. The family of the kid I had killed behind me screaming, fucking murderer. And feeling like I couldn't ever see myself being whole again. It was just this gut feeling that I was never going to return to the old person and that any of that was never going to return. And it hurt. it hurt every time I went. After 9 months of, let's say, six or seven times of going to court, they struck a deal, and I wound up getting a New York City indeterminate sentencing with 3.5 to 10.5 years. So I went for my county lockup. One day they said, pack up, and I go into the upstate New York prison system. And I can remember, and you go through a lot of things. So at that point, I get sent to a place, and it was kind of nice. It was an old psychiatric hospital that they had fenced in. And I had trees, and I was walking around saying, well, it was a lot better than being locked down in the cages. And I went through a violence program, which was really weird, where you had to wear signs, and it was all behavior modification. But then at some point, they asked me, do you want to go to AA? And I said, yeah, I'll go to AA. Yeah, maybe it'll help me get paroled. Because my contact with AA in the 70s, were my friends who were real bad drunks would come up and talk to me and say, you know, you should, you know, think about this and, you know, take it one day at a time. And I said, what, one day, one drink at a time. And I was really, really obnoxious about it. And my feeling was they were like, AA was like, you know, people like the Moonies. They were going to shave your head and take you to Boonville. And, you know, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I was really very, it was, and again, it was my atheism saying, what, I don't need nothing. I don't want to have anything to do with you. And so, in a small way, I surrendered and said, yes, I'll go to AA. And then I went into a program that was a 12-step live-in program. And at the same time, I got into college, and I also, it's a year after what I had done, and I have, I think, a one-year delay fuse, because it's also sitting in today as far as a lot of things. But and all of a sudden, it really shook me up what had been going on. And I was glad I was in that program, because I was in a place where I could talk about things. And I was going to this AA meeting every Sunday, and I'll never forget this guy who come in every Sunday night, Super Bowl Sunday, Easter Sunday, he's there. And I was one of the guys who sit in the back. I didn't say nothing and run out as soon as they, you know, call the movement. And there was this old time, this guy, he's kind of a wise guy, but he's an old timer. And he used to sit in there, and he had like 20 DUIs. You know, they gave him state time finally because the judge was sick of seeing him. And he said, thank God I never hit a kid. Thank God I never hit a kid. This guy said it every meeting. And I go running back to my dorm, bury my head in the pillow, and say, why am I putting myself through this pain and misery? And one day I shared with him, and I said, you know, that's what happened to me. And slowly through that, and this is what the Miracle List program really is that I began to heal. And he would tell other people and say, you know, this guy is, you know, listening. And I would listen, and I started raising my hand, and we had guest speakers, and I would thank them. And slowly I would start to open up and tell people what I had done. And the other miracle of healing in AA was to learn I wasn't the only one. The other miracle is that I learned that people had done worse. Had a person there killed both his best friends, same thing. I saw that, and this is true anywhere, at any given time, you go in and you'll find somebody at the meeting who had something worse than you. Something worse happened to them. And it's a humbling experience. And so I get into the program and I like it. I start reading the Grapevine. I wound up writing about my meeting and got it published in Grapevine. I really liked the program, and I'm just chomping at the bit saying, wow, I can't wait to try my sobriety out in the world. But this was not to be for me for a little while. And I went at that 3.5 year mark, I went to a parole board, which was more or less like the Gong Show, bing, next. And they and I was socked with another 2 years to do. So at that point, I knew there was a real good chance I was going to do a 7 year stint. And I settled in. I started tutoring as an adult basic education. I was in a prison where most of the guys couldn't read. They were forced to go to school. I learned my way around. I gathered a little bit of juice. I was able to place guys in jobs. I became what is, I hate the, it's a, it was the AANA secretary where I kept a list. The anatomy of the program in prison is gone because everybody's posted, you got to come, you know. And I, you know, and I used it as a way of distributing materials and really whatever I could see as a 12-step kind of job. And then I would hand it over to someone and go back to tutoring. Just, here, you do it for a while. And it gave them a chance to be on a computer. And I saw that was a good thing to do, too, to let go of it. Let them mess it up. It's okay, you know. They'll get there. Don't worry about it. And a lot of things were coming true for me that I wouldn't believe. One is, I discovered that I was, in a lot of ways, more free, sober in prison than I was getting up every day and hitting that bottle of brandy and every day trying to do this and every day feeling like I was free to poison myself. And my freedoms in prison became, I managed to get into writing in college and I got published and a lot of good things started happening to me. And I learned a little about computers and some very old computers, but they seemed real wonderful to me. And I learned how to hide my files and hide disks and all the things that you do. But I used to always tell guys, and I was there a longer time than most guys, and so guys would be getting ready to go, I'd say, man, when you get out, call the 800 number, find out where your meetings are, be around positive people. You go back to that corner where you were selling drugs, man, that's what you're going to get back into. You're around negative people, you're going to have negative things happen. You're around positive people. And I used to always, you know, temper this with, don't expect to go to a meeting, get an apartment, get a job, get a girlfriend. And, which is very often a misconception. And it's hard to, you know, you want to instill hope, but not make a promise that is not to be fulfilled. So I would say that to guys, but really I'm saying it to myself. And I'm saying it and telling people, do this, do that, and I'd see if you come back. And they didn't do that. They didn't follow the suggestions. Didn't follow the suggestions, did you, Joe? Nah. 3 to 5. So, I got really tied into. I got a really good program for myself. I'm running computers, doing all these things, going to meetings. Got more meetings brought into the prison. Really involved and I really liked it. And got a really good relationship going with the volunteer sponsor who came in. Became like, he was like Will Rogers. That's what he was like. His wisdom was just so down home. And he would say things that would just cling to you. We used to call him, he really dropped a jewel. You know, everybody in the room would just stop and listen to this guy. And he didn't speak that much. He let everybody else speak, you know. And, you know, I heard a lot of incredible stories in there. So at one point they said, well, you know what, Bob, you're ready to go to minimum status and go to the camps. Well, I don't want to go. I got a good, this is good. I don't want to go out there. You got them double bunked out here. I got a single room. Got my computers. Well, guess what? You don't have a lot of choices. And one day they said, pack up. And it was either that or go to a very little room. And it was a single room for a little while, which you didn't want. So I packed up and I went out to the which is like a little step out into the world. And I go and take this little baby step out in the world. And my higher power, who takes different forms, sometimes very much a comedian, very much, sometimes a very hard taskmaster and lesson placer and fronter. He puts me on this crew with these guys who were, they were happy to have me because I had carpentry skills, and I go to work at a children's museum. And the children's museum is full of children running around, and I'm crying. And then, so that worked out. It was something I had to go through. And then I was lucky after that job, I wound up, building a library way up in the Adirondacks and got my picture in the paper with the crew and it was looking good. And all of a sudden, you know, the sergeants are coming out and saying, wow, these guys did good work. And, you know, it was all looking good and I was getting into it. I threw myself into it. I forgot about that computer. I forgot about that stuff. I kept going to AA at times being one of three people at a meeting and one of two people at a meeting. Sponsors didn't, the volunteers didn't come in there. And I would just use it as a chance to ask people what their experience with AA was out in the world. And because I had none. And you know, I soaked up information and learned that, you know, AA is about people, two people together as a meeting. And that was an important lesson to me. It didn't have to be a big place. It can be just a little place, and that's okay. I kept doing real well out there, and I did. I hope I'm doing good with time.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So I get out there, and I'm working at a church, and I befriended a minister, and she was very kind to me. She wound up counseling me in a lot of spiritual things that helped me see my way through what was going on, and that kind of culminated with one day I'm with a bunch of kids sorting screws in this church, you know, and the guard comes in and looks and he goes, huh, you know, because you remember that day at the children's museum. So I come up on that 5.5 year mark and I go marching into the parole board, which is like the Olympics of stress. And I sit down and they ask me questions and all of a sudden I'm talking about relapse prevention and drug programs that I've been facilitating and all these good things and all the great words are coming out of my mouth and I'm thanking God that the right words are coming out of my mouth and they're coming out and they're coming out and I'm looking at my watch, they're coming out for 20 minutes. I'm sitting there in the Olympics of stress for 20 minutes talking and that's good because they're all asking me, all three of them are asking me questions and I get out and it's like, wow, I got a chance. They might let me go. So I have 2 days of absolute stress wondering what the hell's going to happen to me. I called my cousin. I said, could you buy me a shirt? I think they might let me go. And my cousin said, oh, So finally the decisions come down. They announce it over the PA system. The place was like an old high school. You know, it was like you're living in your high school again, the hallways and stuff. And report to the principal's office and find out if you're going to stay here a few more years. I go down there, go into the senior counselor's office, and the senior counselor's there with his wife was also a counselor, and they know me for a long time. They had been involved in the AA program, too. They sit me down, I open the envelope, please, no, I don't get to go. So they said, well, what do you want to do? Now I had choices. Wow, what do I want to do? Well, and they meant, do I want to stay there and continue being a carpenter and working out in the world and being able to, you know, they would buy us pizza. That's a big thing. Get pizza on Friday. Ooh, Cokes. Oh, man, it was nice, you know, and see women and all these things that are just held up in this giant thing to you. And I looked at it, I said, you know, thanks a lot, but I'm going to go back to that meeting where the 1,500 guys are, not because I'm a big macho jerk, but there's computers there, and you got a good AA meeting there. And I said, okay. And they packed me up, and I went back, and I climbed the ladder again back to a one-man room and got back. My boss saw me come back in. He says, I don't believe it. He put me back at work. And I went back into the Sunday night meeting, and he goes, wow, you're still here. So, yeah, I took 10 months off out there in the minimum. They knew I was there. And at this time, I had 18 more months to do. And I would have to say that those were the days that sort of dragged because it's just knowing that there was going to be a time when I was going to get out. I kept going to meetings. And a lot of guys said, why do you keep going? You're getting out anyway. What's the matter? Where you go? And the other great controversy, I used to love this guy, says, none of this time counts now because you're not faced with the flashing liquor sign. You're not faced with the bar at the corner. I said, yo, man, you know there's plenty of drugs. You can be getting high any time in here you want. And this time counts. And the sponsor, he used to come in, he'd chip in and say, yeah, that's right, this time counts. Don't let anybody take it away from you. It counts. He says, I don't know if I can stay sober in this place. And although the god-awful smell of the pruno would make a lot of people stay sober. But anyway, I kept going to this meeting. I loved it. I was we called it chair, but it was actually the secretary for a long time, and I let somebody else take it, and they loved it, and it helps them grow, because when I took the secretary, I was quiet and shy, and didn't want to say much, and then, you know, it was a real place for me to learn to listen and learn to grow. And I watched out as my higher power kind of pushed me into these little situations. One was, getting in the program, I want to hit the home run of amends and write the letter to the family of the kid I killed. Right? Forget the other steps. That's what I want to do. And the priest, he tells me, who are you doing this for? You or them? And I said, well, and I had to come to terms with the fact that it was for me. And he said, because on their part, it may mean a lot of tears, opening a lot of wounds, a lot of pain. He said, why don't you write the letter and just read it to me? And that's what I did. And that was a lot of healing. And I had to see that here I was, the son of a staunch atheist, you know, talking to a priest who had become a pretty good friend. He couldn't believe I wasn't Catholic. I start marking down the calendar, just like in the B movies. Oh, look, only 20 more weeks, 10 more weeks, da da da. And finally, it becomes my day to get out, and I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they're gonna let me go. I figured there's gonna be a catch. You watch, there's gonna be somebody waiting in that parking lot, and I know I did something wrong in my past, and they're gonna pick me up and do something with me. And I thought about all the stuff I left in California. Because remember, I left California. I said I'd be back in 6 months, right? I'd just done 7 years after doing 9 years on the streets. So that adds up to about 16 years. I was glad that I parked in the long-distance parking. So they let me loose. They give you your street clothes, whatever you have. I had some money from a story I sold. I had a little extra money. But they gave me $40 on top of that. They let me loose. And I go to a shopping mall. One of my college teachers picked me up and she kept me the night. I wound up going the next day. My cousin picked me up and she took me to where my father's family had property in Ohio. And I got to swim in a lake and walk in the woods and just sort of get in touch with things. And I kept my readings, my books. I kept them with me like, ugh, you know. And I was already on like my fourth and fifth year in the book. And I used to write little things in the books on each year. So I'm reading the books and I'm like, wow, free. I'm actually out. And there's a tremendous feeling of overwhelmingness. I remember going in the mall to pick out toothpaste and like, choices. You know, I didn't know how to cope with a lot of that. And it's a very, very strange feeling. And I had to go back to my feelings of what it's like to be green in the program and feeling awkward and not belonging. And all those feelings come back to me even after all those years of sobriety. So now, my aunt and uncle buy me an Amtrak ticket, first class, to go to California. And now, I'm in the Amtrak in this nice little berth, and the announcement comes over the PA. It's not come down, it's, would you like any alcoholic beverages, your favorite alcoholic beverages being served at the bar car right now? And now, the green feeling and that feeling of being a newcomer, just it's all coming back, and I'm saying, wow. Look at this. I thought and that complacency, man, that's why I go to meetings. I never want that. And it just, I think that, again, my higher power reminded me, don't get complacent in your program because, look, you know, it can be lurking behind and catch you at any moment. So I do my readings and I get to California and I'm back in California, September 1996, 1 year ago. 1 year ago. Fires out. I get to California and I come up to Fort Bragg where my mother's living. My mother had come to visit me a few times and we had reestablished a really good relationship and this is how the program works in me that I don't even pay attention to it sometimes. Is I'm living with my mother, a sober son that she never had, and making that amends every day and not even seeing it for the first week or two and then, you know, all of a sudden realizing that's how I make amends is by doing those kinds of things. But I get here and I get on my little bicycle in Fort Bragg and I go to room 449 and I see the promises and the steps on the walls. I felt like, I just looked at it and I know there's a few people in this room who were there the day I walked in and I said, wow, you know, this, I didn't have to show my ID to it. Officer to get in here and now look, you know, and it was just such an incredible feeling to be there and people coming in and coffee at the, it was just everything and it was so wonderful and I sat there and absolutely blissed out and I'm sure it's annoying to be around me. I'm so thankful and grateful and blissful and everybody's got their little problems and they look at me and I'm like, ah. But I did manage to just see that this was where I was going to use the program and listen to people and understand what it's like to be sober on the outside. Because I needed those tools. I needed to hear them from you. And I needed to hear them every day. And I did. And that's how I stayed sober. Because the overwhelmingness of having choices and all that responsibility for my life, which was taken away from me in prison, and suddenly thrust upon me when I had to go look for a job and register for this and do all these things. You know, I needed this program. And I needed it so badly. And it became what I clung to help get me through each day. And all the things that I thought would never happen for me, and now I just get into the promises and what happened. I came out, and I had applied for a school for college while before that second parole board, Mr. Optimistic here. And when I got turned down by the parole board, I rewrote the college and said, due to circumstances beyond my control. And they knew where I was, so they called, and they said, well, when you get out, why don't you come by? I went by, and I went to this interview. And at first it was this guy had a lot of serenity. He said, yeah, I see no problem with you coming. What? No, it's no problem. So I said, oh, good. It's something fishy here. I went back home, back up to my mom's, and I get a letter from the dean of admissions. He says, we would like to talk to you in person. So I went back down, and I had a half-hour interview, again, praying for the right words to come to my mouth, and they did. And I talked about what it was like to go to college in prison, what it was like to be sober. And the guy was very understanding, and he said, you know what? You're not the first person on parole to ever apply to this school. But then the unspoken part was, you may be the first person to get in. And I was. Well, at least I got in. I got a driver's license back. Unbelievable. First of all, what kept me from getting the driver's license, and was an incredible amount of paperwork dealing with the twin nemesis of Albany and Sacramento, was not what I had done to get to prison, but all the things I had done before. And and cleaning up all that wreckage took a lot of letters back and forth, a little bit of money, and a lot of patience. A lot of patience. And a lot of patience with shady lawyers and all sorts of weird people that have no program, you know. And I got my license back. And then, and this is where my higher power is a bit of a comedian. There was always this wanting of, female companionship while you're in prison. And I got two ladies instilled in my life who were very wonderful. And that was hard. And and I see him laughing. And I wonder what's going to happen. And then I see that also the ability to spend time with my mom like that, who's 80 years old, and what that is, and that kind of promise being fulfilled. Never thought that would happen. I sat in there all that time figuring that, you know, that was something that was not going to happen. I was never going to be able to regain my any kind of a relationship with her. Oh, and then, I always forget this part. One day on the phone while I was in the prison, my mother goes, are you sitting down? And I say, yeah, we're allowed to sit down when we make the phone call. She goes, no, stupid. Are you sitting down? And I said, oh, no, you know, something bad has happened. But there was no doom and gloom in my mother's voice. And she says, you have a 17-year-old daughter. And I went, what? And now the old me says, denial. No. Check the DNA. No. But it was actually, and through an incredible series of circumstances, it was true. It was someone from Humboldt County who was married to someone else who chose not to tell the child for the first part of her life. And it's funny because now my programs, I sat and said, damn, she should have told me first before when I was in San Francisco. Maybe I would have straightened my life out. Maybe all this wouldn't have happened to me. And then the good part of me sitting on the other shoulder says, now, you know that you can't have things like that. The way things happened were the way things were meant to be. And maybe because I was such a mess then, I wasn't meant to have that daughter in my life. So she wrote me, and I wrote her back, and I said, listen, if you just wanted to find out who I was and go on with your life, I understand because you're a grown person now. And she said, no, I'm really glad that the person who I thought was my father wasn't my father. And I said, wow, that's... I won that one by default, and got a relationship where we wrote each other. She sent me pictures. And in September, when I came to Fort Bragg, she drove down from Humboldt County and got to meet. And she had already established a nice relationship with my mother, so that was a big thing. I look back now, and here it is. I just came back here tonight after being gone for about a month or so, and feeling so much warmth in the whole region, and feeling like I'm not a city boy anymore. I really like the country, but knowing that I'm doing the right thing for myself, it's just again those feelings of loneliness and of being different. I'm walking around on this campus, 43 years old, and everybody's 19. They're younger than my daughter, and it's a powerful lonely feeling. And the city tends to be a lonely place than any place. I remember some of my loneliest times in the world were in New York City among a lot of people. And the place where I go where I'm not lonely is meetings. And that's still a place, since I've only been down there a few weeks, where I'm finding it's a whole new world down there. And it's a lot of different things. And it's important that I see all that it is and then choose my meetings. Shop for my meetings like I shop for everything else. But I had these feelings of being different again. And I was remembered as a kid being different and what that was. And knowing that in the end that'll work out. And so the first week, and then I realized everybody feels different because they're all new. And this kid turns to me after this literature class and turns to me after the class. We both exited the building. And she turns, she goes, "You know, I really like what you said in there." And man, if I heard that at meetings, you know. And so I said, you know, this is all going to work out too. And I think that's one of the great things, that in the end, a lot of things work out that you have no concept of how or where or when. And for me, yes, I would say it happened on an escalated timetable in the last year for me. Sometimes that was a hard ride. A lot of it was my footwork and a whole lot of it was my higher power. And I just look at that and say, all that is gone in a flash, just like pulling the plug on a TV if I start drinking again. And all that is one drink away from me. And I am so grateful to be here tonight. I can't tell you. Thank you very much for listening.